The problem of sexual assault on college campuses remains a persistent issue in the nation, and while we don't often like to think about it, it's also a problem here in Wisconsin.
To that end, the State Department of Justice is rolling out some new efforts in order to protect incoming college students from sexual assault and to help those who've already experienced assault. And new proposed federal legislation aimed at fighting campus violence could also be on the way, too.
Joining us now is Carmen Hotvet. She's a violence prevention specialist with University Health Services at UW-Madison. Carmen, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, welcome. Thanks for having me.
We know that sexual assault on college campuses is a huge problem, but can you give us some statistics that really put it into perspective?
Sure. So some of the best data we have, wherein researchers have looked at large institutions and asked students behaviorally specific questions like, have you ever experienced someone touching you sexually without your consent? Rather than the question, have you ever been sexually assaulted? Let us know that roughly 20 to 25% of college age women experience sexual victimization between the time they enter college and the time they leave. So that's really a very age specific demographic. We also know that men experience sexual victimization in their collegiate experiences as well. So it's a huge problem. And then on the other side of that, we know that many students have lots of misinformation about these crimes and feel disempowered about what they can do or scared to think about it happening to them. And so we have an obligation as college campuses to provide a safe learning environment that supports a safe response to these issues.
And I think you bring up an interesting point right off the bat there, that when we think about sexual assault, you know, we might think of the more violent or extreme versions of that. But how do you define it? Are those, you know, inappropriate touching, or, you know, what is the range of issues that fall under the umbrella of sexual assault?
Sure. So sexual assault is really any form of sexual contact without consent. So that can include kind of inappropriate sexual touching in public places up to penetration without consent. And lots of people think that overt force or physical violence is used in most of those cases. And at least among the college population, what we know is that the violence itself is the sexual violence. It's the taking advantage of someone's body. It's not necessarily a weapon involved or overt physical mm-hmm. violence beyond the coercion and lack of consent.
How much of it do you suppose goes unreported?
Well, based on a series of other kind of good research data, we know that roughly 2 to 13% of college-age women report to either law enforcement or a campus official. So most sexual violence on college campuses go unreported for all sorts of reasons.
Once something does go reported, or once you even have a suspect name, for example, on average, how many people may have been victimized by that perpetrator?
Dr. David Lisak is kind of the forerunner research in this area, and his research really looked at almost 2,000 college-age men and asked them a series of questions that would indicate perpetration. And based on his research, he found a couple of interesting things. He found he debunked the idea that just because 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 college age women experience sexual assault, it doesn't mean that 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 college age men perpetrate that. He really did find that only about 6% of the men in his studies, and his studies have largely been duplicated with other similar sample sizes, that about 6% of college age men perpetrate, and a little under 4% of them serial perpetrate. And in his study, found that on average, they had perpetrated 6 times by the time they completed participation in a study. Mm-hmm. So what we know is we have a small group of college-age men perpetrating repeatedly and serially.
Well, the State Department of Justice has already made let's take a step back and talk about what Attorney General Van Hollen announced yesterday. Why don't you bring us up to speed there?
Sure. So I just have a statement right here in front of me, and it highlights a few things. One, that campuses are welcoming students back, that the national attention to sexual violence highlights our needs as college campuses to be more forward-thinking in how we prevent them, respond to victims, and hold perpetrators accountable. And what part of what his statement really indicates is that they are working to ensure that the crime labs are testing the the evidence that the medical forensic exam evidence that may be collected, whether or not the survivor chose to provide a name. And it's a trend that's happening all across the country, that testing anonymous, what people colloquially call rape kits, and they're really forensic exam kits, can help link serial perpetrators even when you don't have an individual police report because of the DNA evidence included in those kits.
So it sounds like what would happen is if a sexual crime is committed, the evidence is taken and stored in the state crime lab. But what if the victim chooses not to press charges? What happens?
So victims really don't press charges. The DA would choose to press charges based on the evidence provided to them from the police agency. So what the testing options provided by the state crime lab allow that a survivor who might choose to utilize their local SANE program, they could report at that point in time. And federal law also says that they can get a free forensic exam or one at no cost without choosing to report to law enforcement. So you can get a free forensic exam and wellness check at your local SANE program without cost, even if you choose not to engage law enforcement. But then what happens with that is the kit goes, without the survivor name on it, to a storage facility. And so that's how that's the strategy to attempt to not only go after folks who have, the people who have assaulted people who choose to report, and it's also the people who choose to gotten help and had some forensic evidence collection regardless of their choice to work with police at that time.
Is there a backlog of cases of those that are being charged or tried? What's the caseload for the state with regards to sexual assault?
Sure. I don't have specific data about the backlog, or if there is a backlog here in Wisconsin. And my expertise is really specific to college-age students. And what we know is most college-age students don't actually choose to report to police directly. And though many of them do choose to utilize their local SANE program and have forensic evidence collected without their name attached to that.
Well, state officials are going to be rolling out new training for students and for college staff and for police across the state to help them find and help victims of sexual assault. Do you know what that training will look like?
I don't know what that will look like, but what I can say is that part of some of the federal changes that have happened are now requiring college campuses to be doing a couple of new things. And some of those are to provide primary prevention or prevention of sexual violence before it happens to incoming students. That includes undergraduate students, it includes graduate and professional students, and new employees. Title IX is now also requiring training of employees to know their obligations to report information once they have information from survivors or knowledge of sexual violence on the campus, even if that wasn't a survivor disclosure, and increased training requirements and standards for the people who investigate those allegations once they've been escalated.
And before we go to news in a few minutes, I'm curious what you believe is the key to preventing sexual assault. I'm sure that that's a multifaceted answer. So, but what do you think is, at the heart of cutting down the number of sexual assaults on campuses?
That's a great question. It is a multifaceted answer. And so I can bullet point out a few things for you.
And we can pick it up after the news, too.
So one of those is believing that sexual violence and forms of gender-based violence are preventable, that they aren't just a natural consequence of being humans or boys just being boys, or that would be a key piece. And working to change some of our social norms that put those things into place. And so the social norm of blaming victims for their own victimization. So that's one piece. We can work to prevent it by believing it's preventable. We can also support survivors who are largely still not supported in systems responses in this nation. And we've made great headway. We're a lot further along than we were 20 years ago, but that we need to support survivors and their autonomous ability to make decisions for themselves. We need to hold perpetrators accountable in our criminal justice systems and our campus disciplinary systems. And then as a community, really need to commit with the ongoing awareness strategies to commit to a campus, in my case, a campus environment that does not tolerate sexual violence.
And real briefly in our last minute before news, what are some campaigns that college campuses have successfully done to raise that awareness?
Sure. The best campaigns are really when awareness is tied to policy outcomes. And so it's not just a couple of posters that get put up in hopes that students would change attitudes or behavior, that it's also really tied to how the institution is responding. And so a great thing UW-Madison has done in the past few years is implement the responsible action guidelines, which indicate that victims of sexual assault or other violent crimes would not be subject to campus disciplinary actions if they were drinking underage at the time of an assault. And this has really reduced a barrier to students who were scared to seek help after drinking underage and they had been victimized.
I see. We're talking with Carmen Hotvedt with the University Health Services at UW-Madison about campus sexual assault. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. We're talking with Carmen Hotvedt. She's a violence prevention specialist with University Health Services at UW-Madison about what's being done to fight sexual assault on college campuses. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. If you're a student, what would make you feel more safe on campus? If you're a parent of a student, are you worried about your child's safety on campus? And what do you think can be done to stop sexual assault on college campuses? Let us know at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Carmen, much of the time the discussion about reducing sexual assault revolves around telling women what to do in order to reduce their risk or to how to protect themselves. Now it seems like there's a shift toward educating men as well about what constitutes abuse and stressing the importance of not doing it. Talk more about that.
Sure. So I think it probably rings true for folks who were in college prior to about 1995 that what used to constitute sexual assault prevention was really giving women rape whistles, maybe a self-defense class that had nothing to do with the realities of sexual violence and tell them to not walk alone. And though those may be decent public safety tips, and we all should take whatever strategies we would like to take to enhance our own safety, one of the realities of sexual violence is 9 out of 10 times it's committed by someone you know. So how likely is it to use a rape whistle when you're having a consensual makeout that gets pushed too far? Or when what happens if the person who chooses to walk you ask to walk you home on the lakeshore path as at Madison has put you into a vulnerable position. And so the shift has really been away from really targeting only women to think about sexual violence, and to not only think about or blame men when we know that very few men, in fact, commit serial perpetration on college campuses, but to engage the entire campus community. And that means looking at gender norms and harmful and hegemonic masculinity. And some of that work has been really exciting and energizing across college campuses. One of the things we do out of University Health Services and through the School of Social Work is sponsor a 2-credit class for fraternity men who are emerging leaders in their fraternities to engage their own communities and their own ideas of masculinity. And so thinking about the relationship between homophobia and violence against women, about their own empathy for rape victims. They sometimes have very misconstrued notions about what sexual violence is, that it's a stranger in the bush, it replicates some sort of mythos about racism in the United States. And that the effort is really to help them engage in their own self-reflection about what it means to be a man, what it means to be a man that isn't defined by what a woman is not, and that gender exists across a spectrum, and then how they can use that internal reflection to build upon leadership skills in their own all-male groups.
And how do you get these leaders to engage in that dialogue without, let me put it this way, how do you have that conversation without the other person rolling their eyes?
Sure. So part of what I'm really proud of in the End Violence on Campus office that I helped to manage at University Health Services is that work is really deep, and it's about the relationship among the men and the relationship among their facilitators to them. So it's not a one-time conversation. It's an ongoing relationship that engages their whole self as a person on the campus and a student on the person with other men. And asking them to think about the difficult ways that gender has boxed them in as well, that harmful masculinity hurts men and women. And in fact, we see this play out in sexual violence as well, that men who are experiencing sexual violence almost always experience that at the hands of another man. whether or not that's when they're younger and or when they're older, oftentimes, because that's a form of gender policing. So men who are gay or perceived to be gay are often more likely to be the subject of sexual violence, stranger sexual violence in particular.
We talked before the news about, you said one of the keys to preventing sexual assault is to also support the survivors. And I'm wondering what, you know, the justice system and the Department of Justice, as we're seeing AG Van Hollen getting involved in this discourse, what can they do to ensure that victims are being supported?
That's a great question. And when so few survivors actually choose to go to police or to a campus law enforcement agency. So when they do, it's of utmost importance that those agencies are trained by local victim service providers, that they've listened to victims before, that they're acknowledging that trauma may present very differently for very different people. And so that might mean doing the interview in multiple sections. A best practice would be to always invite the survivor to have a support person or victim advocate with them, to informing them of their rights and their ability to progress at a pace that works for them, and then being transparent about what those processes are.
And obviously each situation is different, but are there certain patterns that we can learn from?
In terms of how perpetration happens?
Yes. Or
One of the things that came out of Dr. Lisak's kind of groundbreaking research really is that on college campuses, alcohol is almost always involved in how predators make victims vulnerable. That does not mean alcohol causes sexual violence. Certainly we see sexual violence in countries where alcohol is prohibited at very high rates. But it does mean that that is their weapon of choice, and that's the way that victims become vulnerable to their advances, that they use hegemonic masculine norms. It's what all guys do. Did you hit that? They use that kind of social norm to their advantage. So it seems to blend in, although most people don't actually adhere to those norms. And they use tools of isolation. Both plying their victims with alcohol and then isolating them from a larger group or room into a room. We see those as very common trends among campus perpetrators.
Now, you work for UW-Madison, but I'm curious if the support systems are similar across the state. What resources are available to students if they are a victim to sexual assault?
Sure. So a couple of things. The White House put out notalone.gov, a great compendium of confidential victim resources on college campuses, including confidential campus-based victim advocates like we have at University Health Services, as well as community-based advocates like those at the local Rape Crisis Center domestic violence program. And so that's a great place for students to know they can get help. And then they should also know that there is an importance around whether or not that service is confidential. And campuses, in an attempt to respond better to these crimes, now get put on notice if a student is talking to their academic advisor or faculty member. That person has an obligation to share that information with campus officials if they're not a confidential source. And that's not always comfortable for survivors. And so we really encourage students to know about which options are confidential.
It's back to school season. Students are starting to move in. I know Madison has gotten a little bit busier now. The streets are bustling. What's your best advice to offer to first-time students on how to stay safe on campus?
That is a great question. One of the things I think that's important and crucial to being a UW-Madison Badger is having social responsibility. And so staying safe on campus relies upon bystanders to intervene in harmful situations and requires that individuals know what those harmful situations are. So coercive behavior, isolating behavior, hyper-adherence to the gender binary or hyper-masculinity, those are red signs, or red flags, rather. And so intervening in those, either by saying like, hey, that's not a funny joke, or by quite literally seeing someone at a party being too drunk to even stand up, and yet there are three men trying to get her phone number or touching her, that's a situation that doesn't require anyone to be rescued. It just might require that students have a responsibility to interrupt and intervene in that situation. And that's really for the benefit of everyone.
Where can people learn more about some of those warning signs and what to do about them?
Sure. We have a great first-year ed program at UW-Madison called Tonight. It is a sexual assault and dating violence program. And the public can actually watch that program at uhs.wisc.edu/tonight. And if they scroll down, they can actually see that program. It speaks extensively about help for victims, reporting options, as well as some of those red flags I just mentioned.
Well, Carmen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Carmen Hotvedt is a violence prevention specialist with University Health Services at UW-Madison.